from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Next on this morning's forum program, he may be the only man in history who has quizzed Salman Rushdie about Pez dispensers and asked former Secretary of State Madeleine Albright about weightlifting and Playboy magazine. Peter Sagal, host of NPR's quiz show Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, joins us to discuss his storied career as public radio host, long-distance runner, author of a book on vices, and extra in a Michael Jackson video. He'll reflect on some of his favorite quiz show moments and what life is like now that longtime scorekeeper Carl Castle has retired. Forum is next. Join us after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to the second hour of this morning's forum program. One of National Public Radio's most popular shows, Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, is a news and comedy hybrid show listened to by some 2.5 million people a week on 450 public radio stations throughout the United States. The show has won an Emmy and a Peabody, and its host since 1998 is Peter Sagal, an avid runner, playwright, scriptwriter, author, and ghostwriter for an adult film Impresario, as well as having been an extra in a Michael Jackson video, a guest movie critic on Ebert and Roper, and a staff writer for a motorcycle magazine. I think I covered most of the bases there, but hundreds that I haven't
seriously.
Even had.
Anyway. At this point, you can just start making up stuff and nobody will care. Speaking of making up stuff, as much as I would like to impress people with bars in bars by telling them we've won an Emmy, we actually never won an Emmy. I think, and I'm not sure of the rules, but I think you actually have to be on television first.
Well, you were almost on television. There was a deal that was supposed to happen with BBC, wasn't there?
Yeah, we have almost been on television a couple of times. Either we're not good enough for TV, or we're too good for TV. I can't tell which because it hasn't quite worked out.
To translate, I mean, This American Life being a good example.
This American Life is an excellent example of, although their television version, and they did win an Emmy. Not that I feel any competition with Ira Glass at all. I just want to put the kibosh in that rumor right away. Ira can do whatever he wants with his 5 Peabody Awards. I don't care, but they did win an Emmy. We have not yet won.
Well, I've not won a Peabody or an Emmy.
You and I.
So give me your wrong
facts. What have we done with
here.
Our lives?
Yeah, well, you've done a lot with yours, and your show has become very popular. What people may not know, in addition to all this other information about you, which we will go through to some extent in this hour, I hope, was something that, thanks to Irene Noguchi, our producer, we picked up, and that is an appearance on Jeopardy back in 1988. Can we hear that?
Peter Sagal, originally from New Jersey. You're a writer?
Yes.
Fiction, nonfiction, what?
Whatever I can get paid for. Right now, I'm working on a screenplay.
Oh, good.
Just starting out.
That's tough, though. Well, what do you do to pay the rent when, because getting a screenplay sold is...
Well, I'm appearing on Jeopardy. Beyond that, it's been a little hairy so far.
All right, well, if you're going to make money on this program, you've got to finish on the plus side.
Yeah, thank you, Alex. Thanks so much for playing that. It was a couple years after that that I finally removed the clamp from my testicles and my voice lowered, just so you know. I don't know why I did that.
What was that clamp doing on there?
Somebody told me chicks would dig it, but really, listening to my own voice from, 25 years ago is a little terrifying.
If you'd had them removed, your voice would have just
That's true. It would have stayed
like
there.
Like the acapella people.
That's true. I could have been the only castrato in public radio. Well, the only openly...
Well, but now you have that
person in public radio. This is a dangerous line of humor to go down.
Yeah, we'll stay away. Actually, I was wondering that. I
mean, let's talk.
You like to get bawdy. You write about things having to do with, shall we say, the licentious side of life.
I did, yes.
And you seem to have an interest in that shows a high-ranging libido.
Call me quirky.
Well, all right, I'll call you whatever you like. But, do you ever get in that kind of gray zone sometimes and you feel I'm not comfortable?
Well, we have on Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, we all basically have the sense of humor of your average eighth grader. And that's not necessarily a good thing. But it turns out that seems to be true of everybody who listens to our show. When we started the show, and this was 16 years ago, I remember the show launched. It did not do well at first. I don't believe it was on here in the Bay Area at that time. It was on very few stations. And then we had a chance to relaunch the show with myself as host. And we had this meeting where we sort of said, well, what are we going to do? Our time is limited. You know, the station community was rising up in anger at this crappy show that they were supposed to be broadcasting. So we thought our time was limited. And we said, what should we do? Should we try to make a serious news quiz so public radio listeners can hear it and answer questions correctly and then feel smug, which is the number one hobby of your average public radio listener? Or should we just goof around, make jokes that crack us up and do it until they stop us? And we chose option number two.
The option was clear.
And what's amazing is that everybody, enough people out there share our really crude, stupid sense of humor.
You inflating yourself with eighth grade?
I mean, maybe.
Sometimes it's pretty
interesting. There are days, particularly when we get heavily into the scatological stuff. I think eighth grade is what we should we leave that behind as we plunge downward. But yeah, so you asked about sex stuff, because what better to talk about on public radio at 10:10 in the morning? The book I wrote, the book of Vice, Naughty Things and How to Do Them, which is a complete misnomer. There's really not a lot of instructional material there, was really written from the perspective of somebody who was and is pretty vanilla in his tastes and his activities, but kept hearing about all this really cool stuff going on in the world, all this louche stuff. In fact, one of the first places I went to and write about in the book was, I don't know if it's still around, but it was called the Power Exchange. It was a club here in San Francisco. I don't know if it still is. And it was...
Somebody may be listening who will inform
who will
us.
Who will call somebody, yes, the Power Exchange.
And do some marketing.
And it was just this insane, blatant ripoff. And excuse me if you're a Power Exchange fan, but that was my view of the facility. And to a great extent, my book was not so much about all the crazy things I've done, because I've done very few crazy things, but about all the things you've heard about that make you wonder about what kind of life you could be living if you were a little bit more brave or a little bit more bold. And so I went out and I talked to people who were living that way, and I kind of reported back to the much broader, bland community of which I am a proud representative.
That then was this the is point. The Book of Vice.
This is the Book of Vice.
In fact, there's a line that that I actually liked. You went to see some guy, Ross, in a swingers place.
Yes.
And it was a good line. You said, you quoted him as saying, taking a look at you now, I don't think you have anything to worry about because you want to go in there and not do any swinging. You
yes.
Observe
no, no.
Nobody was going to swing with you.
Yeah, it was hilarious. Thank you. The swinger humor. Yeah. Because well, I was talking to him because he ran a private swingers club and I wanted to go in and observe, but I wasn't going to be participating. And, you know, I was sort of raising the question, well, what do I do if, you know, people approach me and want to, you know, get busy? And he looked at me and said, I really wouldn't worry about it. Thanks a lot, Ross. Like,
good
this man. Guy was a looker.
Much more handsome with the beard now,
thank
which
you.
Peter has. And
Rabbinic.
We're not going to get into this whole stuff about strip joints here and swingers and
I think your
places.
Listeners demand it.
National Public Radio
also,
listeners.
we can make Penthouse Forum jokes. Exactly. How many people? Michael, I never thought I'd be talking to you today here on Forum. Anybody?
Some of this humor that you have may go back to your Jersey roots. That's what
think?
I was thinking when I heard you when I heard Trebek talk to you about being from Jersey.
Yeah.
I mean, Stewart, you know.
Yes.
Yeah, there's some real sort of zeitgeist there.
I was
there?
Once on a list by compiled by New Jersey Jewish News of the top 10 Jewish entertainers from New Jersey, and Stewart
Whoa.
Was number one, and I was like number nine, somewhere down there below Jason Alexander. I don't remember who number 10 was, and I feel sorry for him.
How many Jersey people do you think?
Well, Jersey.
Jersey natives born in Jersey.
Yes.
Become comedians.
I think, well, the Jewish comedians, as you know, there's a tradition, and Jersey gives you a lot to complain about.
And then you went on to Harvard.
I did.
Are you one of those guys when people say, where did you go to school? You say, Cambridge?
Yeah, or Boston, which is the classic answer. Yeah. I recently had my 25th reunion because I'm old, and we were all talking about that everybody who goes to Harvard never figures out how to say where they went to school, because either you do, as you say, well, where'd you go to college? Oh, yeah, in Boston. Boston Community College Vocational Tech, whatever. Or you try to say it, but there's no way to say it without being self-conscious. Like, where'd you go to school? I went to Harvard. And you try to be casual, Harvard. You can't, because you feel like an idiot. You feel like you're basically bragging just by saying
you're just showing off by mentioning the school.
And it doesn't seem fair.
People don't feel that way in England about Oxford and Cambridge.
I know.
Or people don't feel that way about Stanford, which now is considered in some lights better than Harvard.
I'm glad they think that.
Well, it's not only they who think that, by the way. There have been some recent...
Yeah, I know. It's particular. I think you can even like...
New York Times story, in fact.
Oh, did they really?
Yeah.
I'm glad they... I'm sure they have it pinned to the refrigerators. That's good for them.
Talking to Peter Sagal, and talk about your career and all that, such as it is, and such as it continues to flourish, and he's going to be here in San Francisco. What do you got planned, by the way, while you're here? 3 weeks in San Francisco?
3 weeks in San Francisco, and this is not sucking up. It is and always has been one of my favorite cities in the world.
But you're a Bedouin. You're a Boston Red Sox fan.
Yeah, I know.
You're now in Chicago, been in New York, right?
Yep.
Jersey boy.
New Jersey. Yeah, you like to go. And in from 1987 through 1992, when that horrifying Jeopardy clip was made, I was living in Southern California, which you'll all be pleased to know I loathed, right? That's the appropriate attitude. So instead, even though I was trying to pursue a career in LA, I was constantly coming up to San Francisco and spending as much time as I could here. In fact, I spent the summer here in 1989 doing a play somewhere, I guess it was in the Mission at a theater space that I think a total of 14 people saw. I mean, over the course of 3 weeks.
You got some theatrical roots, too.
Yeah, I do. I used to be a theater guy. I was an actor. I was primarily a playwright. That was my business when I got a phone call from NPR asking me to be a panelist on this radio show 16 years ago.
But what some people may not know about you is that you have distinguished yourself mostly in running. Beyond,
which is weird.
Yeah, I mean, long-distance runner.
I'm a squat Jewish guy from New Jersey, and yet here
I am.
The guy
who at one time weighed in at 200 pounds?
In fact, yes. Yeah. God, you know too much.
They tell me that all the time, but it doesn't get me advanced in life. So.
No. But yeah, I became – I had a classic midlife crisis in that I was turning 40, and I said, oh, my God, I'm turning 40. I'm going to die someday. And then I said, oh, I know if I run a marathon, I won't die.
That's very logical.
Yeah, it seems
Jim Fix kind of gave
yeah,
me.
Yeah, I know.
In fact, he was an idol of your dad.
He was. He was. You have done your research. Yeah, Jim Fix was. I grew up reading Jim Fix's book, The Complete Book of Running, which was sort of, if not the fuel, or at least maybe the spark of the 70s running boom. And Jim Fix famously became this avatar of running, this celebrity, did an American Express commercial.
And died young.
He died at the age of 53 while running. They found him lying by the side of the road.
like roadkill.
Well, no. And so I ran this marathon. I ran the 2005 Chicago Marathon in about 4 hours, and I finished it. And I had to mention my time. That's how we are. And I was standing there, and then an amazing thing happened, which is that I said to myself, I wonder if I could do that faster. So I've spent 10 years sort of falling into the world of not competitive, but sort of obsessional runners. I'm a columnist for Runner's World. I've run 12 marathons, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah, you started an OCD runner's club, in fact.
Yeah, we did. I run with a lot of other similarly compulsive middle-aged men outside Chicago where I live.
And Boston still is where your heart is?
Boston, I guess to paraphrase...
You did run a marathon. In fact, you ran during the bombing, didn't you?
I did. I was 100 yards away from the bomb when it went off. I had been invited to run the Boston Marathon. I believe it was my 10th marathon as a guide for a blind runner in Boston. And for those who don't know how this works, you know, blind runners, depending on their level of their disability, need guides to show them where to go to keep them out of trouble. I was lucky enough to guide a runner named William Greer from Austin, Texas. He had a tough day, but he was heroic. He managed to run that last mile. We crossed the line. I was congratulating him and hugging him on a race well run, and then there was an enormous boom right behind us, and this huge cloud of smoke went up. So we had just crossed the line and out of harm's way. And I remember thinking to myself, well, it sounded like a bomb. It can't be a bomb. What are the chances? And I, like I bet you did, grew up with a Jewish mother, and my Jewish mother was constantly worried and constantly expecting the worst to happen or to have happened. If I don't call for half an hour, obviously I'm dead. So in reaction to that, I had always developed this, no, come on, nothing bad has happened. So I was standing there 100 yards away from the carnage going, no, nothing bad has happened. I'm sure it was just a firecracker of some kind. And it wasn't until sometime later that I realized that we had just missed one of the worst things ever to happen to our sport ever. So it was an interesting day.
Did you call your mother?
I did call my mother subsequently and said, I'm fine.
Talking to Peter Sagal, who is NPR's host for Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me. Let's get a little bit behind the scenes with
yes.
you. How many writers do you have?
We don't have any writers per se. We have a staff of, we have five producers. They are, and I will name them, Ian Chillog, Mike Danforth, Miles Dernboss, Eva Walchover, and Doug Berman oversees us from his perch in Boston. And we all together write and research the show and contribute everybody.
It's a collective effort.
It's a collective effort. It's sort of a classic TV comedy writer's room type thing. We sit around a table.
Is anybody laughing? I remember comedy writers telling me that they would sit there and crack jokes at one after another, and nobody would laugh.
Well, the classic joke is, how does a comedian laugh? Oh, that's funny.
Yeah, right.
That's how we do it. And no, we actually have more fun. We actually crack each other up, although there's a danger that if you just make each other laugh too much, then you will go on stage and do some joke that had everybody, you know, crying. They were laughing so hard in your writer's room, and it will just die because you kind of had to be there. So we write and rewrite and argue and pitch and improve and punch this script between the five of us. By the time we're all done, nobody knows who came up with anything.
And sometimes the jokes that come out improvisationally are much funnier anyway.
That's the great tragedy, is we'll work all week on a joke. I'll get up on stage, and one of my panelists off the top of their head, let's not call it a tragedy. Well, it's my personal burden. We'll come up with something so much funnier than anything we worked on all week that the joke we came up with disappears into the ether and their joke gets broadcast. Ah, well.
Well, you tape on Thursday and you air on Sunday. And I got to tell you, you know, we'll do a news program.
Well, not necessarily.
Isn't that usually the way it goes?
Well, no, everything's right except, of course, any given station here or anywhere can broadcast it when they like, starting at, I think, 10 a.m. Eastern Saturday morning.
But you got, you know, this whole problem of news shelf time. I mean, we'll have a program that we rebroadcast at night, say at 10 p.m.
Yeah.
And we can't broadcast it because the news will have changed by that time. You must be facing this on a regular basis.
Well, we do. The main advantage we have is most of our stories are so stupid that they're not really affected by breaking news. I mean, if a guy got caught with eight lemurs down his pants at an airport on Tuesday, chances are there won't be any developments in the story late Friday that we have to address. So we have that advantage. I think that the people who do the kind of news that we make fun of on the show, they want to be on the show. So nobody is going to break into a house and leave their resume, for example, which has happened and we've reported on late on a Friday. Because they want to, if they're going to do that, you want to be on Wait, Don't Tell Me. They're going to wait till Monday to get into our news cycle.
So people aren't getting news from your show like they are from Colbert and Stewart.
People say they do, and that really worries me.
It worries
me
they say that about this program. We're hard
news. Yes. And Lord knows. I mean, if this is the only information you get, this is terrible.
You know, I'm also wondering about a number of things in terms of how you elect panelists. And I know people are always interested in that. You're going to be having some people here, some famous Bay Area people as panelists. The more famous, the better, you know, more diversity, all those kinds of things. What goes into your decision making?
Well, let me see if I can draw a distinction. There's our panelists, who at this point are...
And your special guests.
Yeah, special guests.
Yeah,
panelists,
sorry,
special guests.
Right.
So the panelists, when people know, they know the voices, they know the people, the cast of characters, Paula Poundstone, Roy Blunt.
But
Jr.,
even that selection process interests people.
Yeah, it's a little strange how we find people, and everybody has their own story. And I like to think of myself sometimes as Jim Phelps in Mission Impossible, picking out the people for their skills. Oh, we need a curmudgeonly conservative. Let's bring in P.J. O'Rourke. Oh, we need an avuncular guy from Alaska. Here's Tom Baudet. Or we just need Paula Poundstone, whatever she is. And so they're our cast of characters, and they're people who we like to hang out with, and we believe, because people listen to the show, that our listeners like to hang out with. So I like to think of myself as sort of hosting a really fun dinner party every week, except it's broadcast on the radio, usually before lunch. Other than that, it's just like that, in that there are people you like hanging around, talking about the news, cracking jokes.
But I read an interview where you said, I would love to have Boehner. I would love to have W.
Well, those are our special guests because we of course, have a segment called Not My Job, where we invite celebrity guests on. By the way, when we first started, we had no clout, no prestige. So the only people we could get were other public radio people. So we had everybody who worked for NPR on our show as a special celebrity guest.
You even had, as a prize, Carl Castle's voice.
And always will, as long as he wants to do it.
One of the nicest, finest men in our whole operation.
Truly
we agree
a gentleman.
On that?
Yes, absolutely. He's a gentleman all the way down. You scratch him and he's more... I actually once asked him. There are many stories about Carl. This is one of my favorite. Carl was our co-host and presiding spirit for 16 years. He's still out there, by the way, still happy and healthy and hale and recording our voice.
Still doing magic tricks.
Still doing magic tricks. And we were on stage and Carl said something like, well, you know, we were talking about the fact that for many years, Carl would fly from Washington, where he lives with his wife, to Chicago or wherever we were every week. And this is a man who was well into his 70s for most of his career with us. And he never complained. And he said, you know, I can't complain. I said, Carl, I'm going to give you carte blanche. It was after the show. It wasn't being broadcast. I was like, whatever you want to complain about, whatever you want to gripe about, now, do it. Everybody here loves you. They'll totally sympathize. Do it. Complain. And he went, I just like my life. That's Carl.
And we're talking about celebrity interviews.
Yes.
I want to get to something with Not My Job. But first, I want to get to a guest appearance that was on the show. And the show had many celebrities. This is one back in August 2013. And you spoke to classical pianist Emmanuel Ax.
Yes.
And you had some fun with the name. Let's hear this.
Let's just go right to the important thing. Emmanuel Ax is the coolest, most macho name in classical music.
It is a little strange.
It's pretty good.
I had nothing to do with it.
Because, you know, we're going to go talk to Emmanuel Ax. And they were like, what is that, a metal band?
there are a lot of jokes, obviously.
Really?
Oh, many, many.
Do you know any better ones than that? Because that was pretty lame.
Well, there's the old standby. I'm not an automatic Ax, I'm Emmanuel Ax.
Oh.
That's good.
One of my favorites was I play quite often with my friend Yo-Yo Ma.
Yeah.
And there's a wonderful German violinist, and people had the idea of putting together the Lizzie Borden trio, because her name is Anne Sophie Mutter, so it would be the Ax Ma Mutter trio.
Well, that may be the most public radio joke ever.
And that may be one of the great moments from Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me. Look, here's what we're going to do.
What are we going to do?
This game that you play with job interviews, I thought of Bugsy Siegel, but that's Siegel, you know.
No, it doesn't work. No.
Jonathan Livingston, the same thing. So your name is close to Steven Seagal, though.
Yes.
I mean, it is the same. Is he a relative, by the way?
No.
Okay. Irene Noguchi, our producer, put this together. So let's give her full props for this. This is a quiz to start you off asking a couple questions about Peter Seagal, about another celebrity named Steven Seagal.
Right.
Okay. Steven Seagal has long been an admirer of Asian culture, so much that he, A, spent 3 years in Japan learning to be a master sushi chef, B, opened his own Aikido dojo in Japan as a seventh-degree black belt, or C, accompanied the Dalai Lama for 2 weeks as his personal bodyguard when he visited Los Angeles.
This is the frightening thing. I actually know a lot about Steven Seagal, and the answer is B. He was the first Westerner to open his own Aikido dojo in Japan.
Well, you're correct. Why do you know so much about Peter Seagal?
I know a lot about Steven Seagal.
Steven Seagal.
I'm Peter Seagal.
Yeah,
he's Steven Seagal.
Let me get you two straight, right.
He's taller, has a ponytail. I'm shorter and balder. The reason I know a lot about Steven Seagal is because I've back in the 80s, I had a real soft spot for really big, dumb action movies. And I saw all of them. And secondly, because I myself practiced and studied Aikido for a while. And
what level did you get to?
I got to brown belt. Not
good.
That great.
That's
and
well.
Well, you know something. And Steven Seagal, much to first our excitement and then our deep shame, became the most famous practitioner of Aikido in the world.
Well, there's another question. We'll see if we can stump you with that. In the meantime, let me invite listeners to join us. I know there are many fans of the show. Opportunity for you to speak with its host, Peter Seagal, and we do welcome your calls and emails, so you can join us now at our toll-free number. It's 866-733-6786. You may have your own moment you want to remember or recall from Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me. And again, you can join us live, 866-733-6786, or email us, forum@kqed.org, or go to our website, which is kqed.org/forum, and click on the segment. And you can also tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQEDForum. I'll just put the second question out here. And no, I don't have time.
Yeah,
I'll come
the
to
theme
it
music is rising, Michael.
That's
we have
right.
to run.
He knows his game. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. Peter Seagal is our guest. He's the only man in history, probably, who quizzed Salman Rushdie about Pez dispensers and asked former Secretary of State Madeleine Albright about weightlifting in Playboy magazine. He's the host of Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me. And we're talking to him about his career, about Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, about all kinds of things related to Well, a strange life that he's lived, varied and fascinating, and a panoply of all kinds of occupations and things. I told him off the air, and I might as well say it publicly, I actually tried out for his job many years ago. I was doing the forum program, and it was sort of a twinkle in the eye of Doug Berman, and he said, and I've been fetching to Kevin Close, who was then head of NPR, nothing done outside of this Washington-centric area.
Washington-New York axis at that time.
And so they thought about maybe doing something here in Chicago. They had other things in mind, L.A., they hadn't even opened the L.A. Bureau at the time.
Long ago.
So this is, as you would say, the Pleistocene era, and what became of it was nothing. They actually just had me to read copy, and that was it. And then a few years later, the program was born. It was pretty amorphous at the time, though.
It was very amorphous. I mean, basically, you know, if you really want to do something sharp, something innovative, something really amazing in comedy, the first people you want to go to is NPR. Let's say this: starting a comedy show was not in their sweet spot, so it had a bit of a rough start.
But Joanne Wallace, our general manager, said, "Why should we do a car show?" You know,
I know, and so, aren't we all grateful for that?
Well, you want the second? You're
let's
an
do
expert
it.
On Steven
Seagal.
This is unfair.
See, the fact that I said I actually know a lot about Steven Seagal dooms me that you are now going to ask me something I have no idea.
Well, but if you know the answer, we'll let it hang as a tease and
please
give it toward the end and see if any of our listeners know the answer.
Okay.
How's that?
Go for it.
Known for playing martial artists and military officers in various films, in real life, Steven Seagal has branched into other areas. Which one of the following is something Steven Seagal has not done? Not done, right. So just tell me if you know the answer.
All right.
A, starting a line of men's hair gel and ponytail ties geared toward martial artists and toward men with longer hair who enjoy the martial arts. B, avid grape harvesting, where he distributes Cabernet grapes from his 200-acre vineyard, and also starred in a video titled The Celebrity Guide to Wine, where his then-wife Kelly asked him, after sampling the wine, was that as good for you as it was for me?
Okay.
C, taking part in a police raid for his A&E show, where he showed up with a tank and dressed in full riot gear at the home of a man accused of illegal cockfighting.
I know the answer.
You know the answer. Okay. You are really a bona fide Steven Seagal expert. I will give you your props.
All right.
All right. Well, we'll let it hang out there for listeners,
please,
and we'll keep the buried.
It's all about teasing the listener, make them listening to find out more about
Steven
Seagal.
Just like when the music comes
don't
up.
Go
you
away.
You got to get out. You got to get into
just professional some, broadcasting, people.
You want some tweets first?
Let's give me a tweet.
First Red Rocks, then a residency in San Francisco. Are you doing this to make Carl Castle wish he hadn't retired?
Probably. I have to say, you know, we did the show in Red Rocks just, gosh, was it last week? It was. And this, of course, is the very famous outdoor amphitheater just west of Denver. It's famous because U2 had a famous live concert there that was on video. John Tesh. We were in the footsteps of John Tesh. And it is just stupid. I think it's an indictment of our culture that my silly radio show gets to play those places. Not only Red Rocks, but Tanglewood, which is where we interviewed Emmanuel
Carnegie
Hax.
Hall.
We played Carnegie Hall three times and the San Francisco War Memorial Opera House. In fact, I was told that don't tell me, set the attendance record at the San Francisco War Memorial Opera House, which again is an indictment, I think, not of us, but of you.
No, it's all to the credit of the host.
I think
that
it's silly.
Has a bit more to do with it. All right. Here's a listener who says, what's your favorite run when you're in San Francisco?
I love to run in San Francisco, although you have these weird geological things. What do you call them? They go up in the air. Oh, yes. Hills. We don't have a lot of them in Chicago. I love to run the city in San Francisco. I'm staying in the East Bay, so I'm running a lot of the hills and parks out there, which is awesome. But I love to run, and I've done this many times, just along the Embarcadero over to Fort Mason, and one day I remember I had a great run here starting way down at the baseball park, ran all the way to what's the fort underneath the bridge?
Fort Mason.
Is that the Fort Mason?
Fort Point.
And just, you know, looking up at the bridge, and there were sea lions mating. I hope they were mating. They could have been having a spat. I don't know. It wasn't my business to ask, but it was a beautiful day.
Do you talk to the sea lions?
I did not talk to the sea. Well, not. If I did, I wouldn't share it with you, Michael. It's between me and them.
Okay. Couple more tweets. We'll get calls. We'll get emails. A listener wants to know, tickets sold out way too soon. Will you put on an extra show or two?
We would love to. We can't because we have to go. We were extremely flattered. Again, a little embarrassed for all of you that the show sold out so quickly. All I can say
is, this is a shame with the show that you have.
I don't know. I'm like, you should have something better to do than to listen to me. That's
what entertainment. I mean, isn't that an important part of people's lives?
Yes, I guess so.
Don't feel ashamed. You're giving them entertainment.
Really, this is San Francisco. This is the head. This is the center of American culture. And you're listening to me make fart jokes. I don't understand.
It's the center of techiness.
I know.
So it would seem.
All I can say is we had three shows. And by the way, we should thank Sydney Goldstein and her organization here, who has the Norse Auditorium, which set us up there. It was an awesome favor to us to be able to spend these 3 weeks. All I can say is, if there is ever the chance to do it again and come back and do more shows for everybody in San Francisco, I personally would love to.
So, let me also thank Sydney Goldstein, who they did a nice tribute, a wonderful tribute, very memorable to my 20 years in broadcasting and at this helm, and she gave us the Norse Theater.
So. Yeah, she's an awesome woman.
She is indeed.
With an unexpected name.
Here's a tweet. Carino writes, what'd you want to be when you grew up?
That is a good question. I had dreams of being an artist, specifically a writer, specifically a playwright. And for a long time, I was going to be the kind of playwright who would shake up the world with my theater and shake all of you poor benighted souls out of your complacency. I thought that I would, at the end of my plays, the audience would either rise up to thank me or to string me up, and either would be fine. And then I realized as I got older that complacency is actually a good thing. I enjoy my complacency, and instead I comfort people with lowbrow eighth grade humor on the radio.
You should be doing a self-help book. Comfort through complacency.
Really, you know, I was thinking about this. Complacency, you know, complacency is what complacent is what the unhappy people call the happy. So let me tell you, it's better to be complacent than miserable.
That's a good line.
Isn't it, though?
Yeah, it's a memorable
I tried this
line.
On this barista down the street, and she was like, I don't know if I agree with you.
Didn't work. One web comment, then we go to calls. Andrea says, if more people had an eighth grade sense of humor, we'd not be in such a pickle today.
That's true. And because I have an eighth grade sense of humor, I'm trying to make a dirty joke about a pickle, but I'm going to let that go.
Oh, actually, speaking about eighth grade senses of humor, I do want to go to calls. But I did want to read this email from Tim. I mostly love Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, but do I detect over the past year or so a gradual coarsening of the humor? Just to cite your most recent episode, you managed to focus on crotch topics twice within the first 15 minutes of the radio broadcast. It is disheartening. Wish you could elevate the discourse instead of drive it downward. By way of compliment, I applaud the way you converse and tease with the celebrities you get to join you on the show. Keep up the great work. Okay, I admit it. I'm the nightmare demographic for NPR's long-range planner, 61-year-old white guy.
Exactly. But however, you are our core. I would say that if you want someone to elevate the discourse, I invite you to listen to anything else on public radio. You know what's funny about that? We go into the script. I was talking about this earlier. We go into the show with a script, and we've got a lot of topics and a lot of different jokes. But we are very much at the mercy of our panelists and also our audience as to what is going to make the show. What do they like best? What do our panelists like best? What gets people going? You know, what sets it spinning? And frankly, it's often the coarse stuff that everybody loves. So, you know, we could either broadcast you the coarse juvenile humor that our audience and our panelists adore and everybody has a great time with, or we can broadcast the more high-minded, clever humor that we think is good for you.
And I have boilerplate sorts of things that I say to supporters of public radio about how we elevate the discourse, how we don't get coarse, all of these kinds of things. You're inspiring me. Maybe
I'm
I want to get more
you.
Coarse.
Your job
in
is to make
grade.
Up for me. No, we get to. We're like, you know, there's this old medieval tradition of festival or carnival or whatever it is, where the roles are reversed and the jester becomes the king. You know, I think there's a scene in Hunchback of Notre Dame when it starts with this. That's us. We're the hour where public radio acts like idiots. Where we just do fart jokes and sex jokes and stupid jokes, and then the rest of public radio looks better by comparison.
How many are you really that rampant with the jokes about? We'll say flatulence.
Because
we're bringing
because
the level
public
up
radio.
Here. No, I'm thinking. I remember one time somebody told me that Howard Stern did like 10 minutes of just flatulence, and I remember when I worked with ABC.
I mean, just flatulence.
Just flatulence. Just,
that's programming
very
genius.
Funny. A name that will not be uttered here on the air, a former boss of mine when I worked for ABC many years ago, said, if that got higher ratings, if it was just flatulence all day, 24 hours, I would play flatulence all day. And that was the attitude. That seemed to me to
that
be a metaphor for how ratings are viewed in terms of commercial radio as opposed to what we do in public radio.
Yeah.
But here you're giving yourself all this coarseness.
The difference between, I think, Howard Stern and myself is Howard Stern does lowbrow humor for money. I do it out of passion. I don't get paid. I'm in public radio.
My boilerplate line, when Howard Stern signed a contract with Sirius, it was for 10 years for $10 million a year.
Yeah.
And I am on Sirius, but I've never been paid a cent for being on Sirius.
Yes,
it's part of the
I.
NPR distribution. All right, let's go to our callers. There's your metaphor.
All right.
Lexi, good morning.
Hi. I love your show, Peter.
Thank
and
you.
I'm calling to Thank you. I've been meaning to write a passionate letter for about 3.5 years, but I wanted to thank you and everybody on Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me for allowing me to get from home to work and from work to home on BART and through the streets of San Francisco without breaking into tears about 3.5 years ago when I went through a devastating divorce.
Oh, you know, I'm sorry, go on.
It was the only thing that would take my mind off of it. So when I wasn't working, I had to think about something else. And Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me was the only thing that got me to and from work.
So Lexi, Lexi, first of all, you're welcome. Secondly, I'm sorry for your troubles. I hope things are better. And I have to say, you know, my instinct is to make a smart remark in the face of this. But I will say, I was talking earlier about my ambitions as a young man when I wanted to be an artist and shock the world and shake people by their collars and wake them up. And instead, I make jokes on the radio, coarse or not, and do very silly things.
And you give comfort to people. Look at this.
Well, that's the thing. Lexi, are you still there, Lexi?
You're not, I am. I'm here.
You're not the first person to come up with me with a story like that. People who have gone through divorces, illnesses, job loss, family tragedies. This happens to all kinds of people. It's happened to me. And to have people come up and say, you know, you helped me through that. That it was a breath of air. It was a bit of brightness in a dark time, means a tremendous amount. Once, and I don't want to compare the stories, but one of the more memorable ones we got was when we were going to go do a show live somewhere. Prior to showing up, we got a letter from a woman, and she said that her partner, a woman, her wife, I guess, had through some trauma or illness, was in a coma, and the doctors told her that her wife was on the edge of life and death, and it was really up to her, herself, the patient, whether she was going to come back or not, and that if they wanted her to come back, they should remind her, insofar as they could, of what she wanted to live for. And according to this woman, they set up a radio or a podcast or whatever in her wife's hospital room to play Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, which she really loved, and she came out of the coma. And
wow.
And we invited them to come see the show. So it was either the most amazing story of my little show doing good that I ever heard, or the most elaborate scam to get free tickets to it that is anybody has ever conceived of. And either way, I was impressed. But the point, Lexi, is that hearing stories like yours makes me feel very good about what I ended up doing for a living. And I'm grateful that you called in to share it. And I hope things are looking better for you. And I hope you still enjoy the show, even if you're happy.
And Lexi, thank you for the call. We'll go to more callers here. I wonder, though, you know, this is what makes us in this business, and we are in the same business after all, even though you continue to talk about how coarse and flatulence and things and put your own talents.
Don't challenge me in this because I'll start swearing now.
Put your own talents down and the quality of, I mean, that call was very important in setting things into motion in terms of what you provide for people. And we provide a lot on this program for people, and the hosts get all the credit, more than we should, because there's so many people behind the scenes doing so much. But I wonder, you know, we're also a vector for other things, too. I mean, we're magnets for animus, for people who, I mean, you get that kind of stuff where people say, well, I just can't stand that host, Peter Sagal. I get it.
Well, you... no. And the reason is, I think, because people who don't like my show, and there are legion, I'm sure, just don't listen to it. We're not that ubiquitous. I mean, I don't think we have that many hate listeners. And I think you, because you're a daily show, 2 hours every morning on KQED, a very, very powerful, popular radio station in a place that everybody listens to public radio, I think you're going to get more than that. You're going to get people who just cannot stand you and yet are driven to listen to you, like they're scratching an itch. It's
well, as long as they're listening.
Exactly. I don't care. Right, exactly. Hate us if you want. No, my show, if you don't like us, and there's lots of reason not to like us, they don't listen. It's actually kind of a blessing. Either everybody likes me or they have no idea who I am.
We'll go to more calls. We'll go to San Jose. George, you're on with us. Hi.
Good morning, Michael and Peter. Welcome to San Francisco, Peter.
Hell, it's a pleasure to be here. It's really a pleasure to be here.
One of the funniest moments on the show, sometimes for me, comes when contestants give improbable responses.
Yes.
And the very funniest one was when you ask a question, something about dinnerware, and the response was, spork, S-P-O-R-K.
Yes.
can you relate to how that happened?
If I remember correctly, it was our limerick game, which, of course, we ask questions about very obscure news stories in the form of a limerick, because you need to rhyme the last word. And the correct answer, I think, was fork, and the guy went for spork. And by the way, I should say that this is one of the reasons why our show is odd, because that was, I mean, if as I relate the story now, I'm sure people all over the Bay Area are not cracking up with the hilarity of it. But at the time, it was pretty funny because it came out of nowhere. And just the whole notion of somebody thinking of a spork as their go-to utensil was, well, it was funny at the time. But one of the nice things about our show, to make it slightly broader, is the show is basically an improv show. We are making it up as we go, and things happen in real time. So when you hear something like that, nobody planned it. And that's also true for what our panelists say, often what I say. It's happening in the moment, and I think that gives our show a lot of appeal.
So in some instances, when someone will narrate what happened, you almost are obliged to say, you had to be there.
You really do, and I think that's part of our show. One of the things I think about is there are a lot of people doing what we do really well. Jon Stewart does what we do really well. John Oliver now. Stephen Colbert, of course, who does it backwards and in heels. And their shows are amazing, and they have staffs of writers who are brilliant, and their performances are amazing. And I don't know if we can compete on those levels, but what we have that they don't is we're live, well, live on tape, but we're live in the moment. We're a little less predictable, more improvisational, a little looser, a little crazier, and I think that has an appeal.
Well, you're talking about your celebrity guests. Back in August 2005, you had a senator on by the name of Barack Obama.
Yeah, whatever happened to him?
Chicago resident. And it turned out he was a longtime fan of the show.
He was.
And he'd just been elected to the Senate, talked about being the newest member to the Senate. Let's hear part of this. He's talking about beginning the small desks that each senator sits in.
But when you pull the drawers open, there are the names carved inside of all the previous occupants of the desk. And so in mine, you know, you'll see names like Lodge and Taft, but you'll also see names like Bobby Kennedy and Paul Wellstone. And it really gives you a sense of sort of the sweep of history that you're a part of now.
Are they supposed to do that? Or they...
You know, I suspect the first couple of guys weren't.
Yeah.
But now it's okay.
I don't think people realize the far reach of graffiti.
Are there little...
Well,
there...
I was thinking about taking a spray can.
You know. Well, that's how we do it in Chicago.
As the only African-American in the United States Senate. That's right.
He does have a good sense of humor.
He does.
Always has.
He came in that room. He had just been elected to the Senate. You know, he made his big speech at the 2004 Democratic Convention and was a rising star, and people were very excited about him. And he remains among the most charming human beings I've ever met. I mean, not in terms of his sort of glamour, but just his ability to relate to the people in the room, to give you the sense, which I'm sure he gives to every audience, like, wow, out of all the places I could be, I'm happiest to be here with you right now.
But I got to give you an editorial comment.
Please, by all means.
Because I've met Obama a few times, and his charm is unassailable, what you've said. He doesn't know the way that – he's sort of aloof with putting this on with the donors, though, and he constantly gets that complaint that he'll go to fundraisers and he won't stroke the way that Clinton could make that person feel in the center of the universe, or W the same way even, you know, just to be nonpartisan here.
Yeah, which I'm sure everybody expects you to be. But the the thing about, Obama, apparently he doesn't enjoy stroking people or giving them the time of day or listening to their advice just because they're rich.
Or small talk because they're rich, you know, which is what good politicians do.
But I got to say, and I take credit for this, Obama left the stage that day, and it was his birthday. It was August 2005, and he left the stage and he left the theater. And as soon as he was gone, I turned to the audience. We were off air, and I said, "That guy's going to be president." So it was my idea.
One of your most prescient moments.
I think so.
All right. So here are some favorite moments from listeners. Sherry,
I have to say this: we're sitting in the studio at KQED, and during breaks, producers are coming in and handing Michael actual pieces of paper.
Interns
are coming in. They're writing them down in the other room. Somebody, this is San Francisco. Somebody make this man an app, please. What is this paper stuff?
Somebody will take you up on it.
I'm sure they will. But
Peter has an impressively quick wit and quips with the best of them, writes Faye. Please tell about celebs who are out of their element on Wait, Wait. My only complaint is some of the guest celebrities are so great, I wish you kept them on for longer segments.
Sometimes I wish we'd do that too. We have on very infrequent occasion broken format. Although at the same time, there have been a couple of times where I have walked off the stage, or rather listened to the show the following weekend, the edited version, and said to myself, well, we've robbing the listeners. That whole conversation was so wonderful. And yet we've edited it down. We should broadcast the whole thing. And then I've gone back and listened to the unedited conversation, and it turns out, no, we pretty much did the right thing by editing that down. One of the really fun things about our show is that most of the people who come on loosen up. A lot of them have done a tremendous amount of media. They interviewed all the time, and yet they don't really get to enjoy themselves. And one of the things that we like to do is knock people off their game, but in a good way. We don't challenge them or frighten them or get in their faces. We allow them to be human in a way. A great example is Al Gore, who came on our show to promote his latest book called The Future.
Who can be human but also can be robotic.
He can be very robotic. And most of the times you've seen Al Gore, he's probably been robotic. That's his mode. And he came on our show and he was an utter goofball. And it turns out that Al Gore has a very high-pitched, dare I say, excuse me for the heteronormative gender role I'm assigning, girlish giggle. And he was hilarious. And I said he giggled at something somebody said. And I said, if you had giggled just once in 2000, you would have been president. Because he was a human being. Madeleine Albright, who you mentioned, was one of our first big gets way back when. And Madeleine Albright, not a funny person you think of, right? If I think, name some funny people. Madeleine Albright, not going to be on the
high
end of
the
list.
She can be clever, however.
Yes.
She's been on the show a number of times.
And we were talking to her, and instead of asking her opinion about the current situation in the Mideast, we were talking to her about her weightlifting regimen, which she really wanted to talk about. And so she was like, oh, yes, I can press 150 pounds with my legs. And I said, that's a useful skill in diplomatic circles. And she said, yes, it's good for kicking ass.
But see, there is a little secret that when you talk to famous people like this, often if you take something like that, like weightlifting with Madeleine Albright, which almost no interviewer would ever think of asking, you get a kind of real keen interest on their part because they want it, like you want to talk about your running. You know?
I mean, intellectuals want to talk about their athletic feats. It's a rule because we just really want to be objectified. Honestly, my dream is to have some beautiful woman look at me and say, shut up, I just want to look at you. But it hasn't happened yet. Could someday. Anyway,
well, I'll tell you
back
what
to your point.
Hadn't happened, which has happened now, is you don't get a lot of that kind of negativity with your show. But you've come to San Francisco now.
Yes.
You've come on the forum program. Let me read one of
those
emails.
Because if you weren't dissatisfied, it wouldn't be San Francisco.
Here's Bob who writes, sorry to interrupt this love fest, but we don't all love this thing. Simple-minded, crude, annoying, loud. It's beyond understanding why NPR continues it. Does Sagal constantly have to prod the panelists to roar with artificial laughter at their not very funny remarks? Give it a rest for good. Well, you're silent, Peter.
I'm like,
what do you say? What do you say? You just say, all right.
I don't know. Fine. You don't like it. You know, I mean, here's the thing. You know, you put stuff out in the world. And people may not like it. It's fine. You don't have to like my show. But I would say to this gentleman, just because you don't like it doesn't mean that everybody else doesn't like it. One of the things that is maddening about public radio is the expectation that it's supposed to be good for you. And one of the things—
it's sort of like asparagus or
a little
broccoli
bit like—well, asparagus actually can be pretty tasty if you do it right. But it's like cod liver oil, you know? And you know, this notion that we're supposed to be high-minded, that we're supposed to be elevating the discourse, that we're supposed to be serious, I think is – I don't know how many people actually enjoy that rather than just thinking, oh, this is objectively a good thing, you know? So that's what we're about on our show is just leaving all of that behind for an hour. And you know, to this gentleman who doesn't like the show, I invite you to turn off your public radio or tune to something else for an hour. When you turn back when we're done, I'm sure there'll be something high-minded and elevated for you to enjoy. In the meantime, somebody has stuffed some lemurs down their pants in an airport and we are on the case.
Well, here's some other side of the coin. Sherry writes, what a treat to listen to you to be interviewed. One of my favorite episodes of Not My Job was an animal officer in Florida who had a kid poke a mop at a snake under the house. When they pulled the kid out by his leg, a huge anaconda was at the other end of the mop. Frank writes, wait, don't tell me is usually a pretty funny show, and I especially like Paula Poundstone's proof that radio and specifically NPR still have something to offer.
Thank you, we do.
Beth writes, we love wait, don't tell me and love Paula Poundstone, who seems to have a very quick wit. Would love to know if those on the panel meet before the show to do any prep work, and how does the show pick famous person who will be the guest each week? We've kind of talked about that, but she goes on to say, love Melinda Gates when she was the guest about a year ago.
She was hilarious. Melinda Gates, who came on the show, and that
who
was another
thought
example.
It, right?
Well, that was a great thing, because here's Melinda Gates. She's a very serious woman. She is, I think, with her husband, the most significant philanthropist in human history. Thank you, Melinda. They actually support NPR, so thank you, Melinda. And she came on, and she, I won't say let her hair down, because for all I know, it's still up there in a ponytail, but she
enjoyed
herself.
And may I say that Bill Gates didn't give nearly as much money until he married Melinda Gates.
Well, there you are. Well, bless her heart. But let me answer a question that was in there, which is that no, our panelists do no prep, at least not with each other and not with us. They come, shall we say, prepared in the sense that they have a vague sense of what we're going to talk about. Certainly if there's been a big news story, they know. But we tried that once. We tried to rehearse material with them or at least let them know what we were going to talk about, and they rebelled. They wanted to be improvisational. And as I was saying earlier, that I think is our appeal. Whatever Paula says, she's saying that.
It's the same thing in some ways with Forum. I mean, people say to me all the time, it's very different than, for example, Terry Gross, because things are edited and things are done not on the fly, and there's Annette, to a great extent, which sometimes I feel, God, I wish I had that. You know?
Yes, that would be nice. And yet at the same time, I mean, if you think of stuff that's really compelling that you've heard on the radio, chances are, well, not necessarily, I mean, there's This American Life and other shows in its mode that do brilliantly produce stuff, but chances are it's stuff that seems spontaneous that you really remember, like that moment with the spork. If we had scripted a joke that revolved around the word spork, nobody would have cared.
So we get back to Steven Seagal for
a
moment.
Yes, one last time.
Before
so you asked the question.
We leave all this, I asked the question and you knew the answer.
I knew the answer. The thing that he has not done is he has not manufactured or marketed hair products.
And that is correct. So just so nobody will left in
the
dark
about
that.
They were hanging out there.
How many shows are you going to be doing here?
We're doing 3 shows at the Norse Theater, tomorrow, Thursday, and then the 2 Thursdays subsequent. We are all sold out, for which I apologize, and I don't know if there's any way to get tickets. I think there's a secondary market, so check Craigslist.
Maybe a black market, yeah.
For all I know, people have written in to complain. Oh, my gosh. You know, they're like, oh, the only tickets I could get were $200 on eBay. And I'm like, I'm sorry? I don't know. It's I'm sorry that if we're sold out. But here's the great thing. They'll be broadcast the subsequent weekend here in KQED, and so you can listen for free in your pajamas while making breakfast.
And is it true that maybe the only time you were starstruck was with Scarlett Johansson?
The thing about Scarlett Johansson, a lot of people were upset with me because it seemed as if we were a little smitten with her, shall we say, feminine charms. I should say that Scarlett Johansson was not in the room with me. I wasn't as if I was.
But you were looking at pictures.
I was absolutely, yes. I was just thumbing through on my iPad. I didn't know. I will tell you something. Scarlett Johansson.
You were charmed by her voice, like in Her.
I had just seen Her, which is a great movie. But I will say that I honestly didn't know what to say to Scarlett Johansson. And so just kind of hemmed and hawed. And people thought it was because I was a sexist boor. No, it's just because I'm really not that good at my job.
I don't agree with you on Her, but I do agree with all the listeners.
You didn't
listeners.
Like Her? We'll have to do another hour talking
about
Her.
It's an okay show. It's a great program. Great show.
Thank you, Michael.
Good to have you here. For all of us at KQED Public Radio, we're just going to say goodbye. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.